The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro. Part 2. Continued on cassette number 6, side 1. Mary found this hard to believe, but when she arrived in Austin to get married, Lyndon Johnson was best man, and to become a secretary in the NYA offices, she saw at once why Chuck believed it. "I find it hard to understand when I talk about it now," she says. "But he had what they call now a charisma. He was dynamic. And he had this piercing look, and he knew exactly where he was going and what he was going to do next, and he had you sold down the river on whatever he was telling you. And you had no doubts that he was going to do what he said, no doubts at all. You never thought of him being only 27 years old. You thought of him like a big figure in history. You felt the power. If he'd pat you on the back, you'd feel so honored. People worked so hard for him because you absolutely adored him. You loved him." She saw why Chuck, and Chuck's brother and Chuck's friends, all the men in the NYA offices, wanted so badly to stay on his team. Working for him was very exciting. Fascinating. History was being made. The country was being turned around. And Lyndon was one of the turners, one of the makers and the doers and the shovers. And you knew he was going to be doing even more. You knew he was going places. And you wanted to be on his wagon when he went. Idolized. "I named my only son after him, and in all probability, as far as I know, he was the first boy to be named after Lyndon Johnson," says Fenner Roth proudly. "The first, but not the last. There would, among others, be not only a Lyndon Johnson Roth, but a Lyndon Baines Crider." Decades later, Willard Deason would be asked about the genesis of the political machine with which Senator Lyndon B. Johnson controlled Texas. "It all went back to that NYA," he said. As Dick Clayburgh's secretary, Johnson had cashed men in bureaucratic nooks and crannies in Washington and all across Texas. His NYA post allowed him to bring these men together under his leadership. Now he could observe them at work, in action. He could assess precisely not only personalities, but potentialities. He could dispense with those not suited to his purposes. Moreover, he could, with more jobs at his disposal, add to their ranks and personally assess the new recruits. The sifting out left him with a cadre of men, perhaps 40 in number, proven in his service, instruments fitted to his hand. Included in their ranks were specialists, not only the gifted speechwriter Herbert Henderson, but a skilled public relations man. In 1936, he brought into the NYA former Austin American managing editor Ray E. Lee. Johnson's ability to see the potential in the most unlikely of raw materials had also provided him with a chauffeur. When Gene Latimer's closest friend, a slow-talking, phlegmatic teenager named Carol Keach, had come to Washington from Houston, Johnson had told him to learn typing and stenography. But, Keach says, "I was very inept. I mean, I was just a beginner." Johnson would not give him a job in his office, placing him in the Federal Housing Administration mailroom instead. But when Maverick was elected, Johnson recommended Keach to the new congressman, who hired him for his office. And on the trip back to Texas, Keach accompanied Johnson. Johnson, who so distrusted other people behind the wheel, noticed that Keach, who didn't talk much anyway, concentrated on his driving. And he noticed that, unlike most of his assistants, the calm young man did not become flustered when he berated him. Now he put Keach on the NYA payroll and used him as his chauffeur. The significant aspect of his earlier network, its statewide scope, was emphasized now. The NYA operated in every one of Texas's 254 counties. The NYA provided throughout Texas contracts to local businessmen who might be politically well-connected, and jobs not only for the cadre but for the public. It did so in a minor way. Its total funding, just slightly more than $2 million during Lyndon Johnson's term as director, was only a small fraction of that spent by the state government or by other federal agencies in Texas. But with 40 men personally loyal to a single leader, with a speechwriter and a public relations man, with jobs and contracts to distribute. It was a political organization. His political organization. His NYA job allowed Lyndon Johnson to expand not just his organization, but his acquaintance. Boston was a city whose life was dominated by politics, as its skyline was dominated by the gigantic pink dome, modeled on, but even larger than, the Great Dome in Washington, of the state capitol. A substantial portion of its permanent population, 70,000 in 1935, consisted of state officials and bureaucrats. When the legislature was in session, the city's hotels and boarding houses were crowded with legislators and lobbyists. If one spent enough time on Austin's main thoroughfare, Congress Avenue, a street built wide enough to allow U-turns by prairie wagons pulled by two teams of horses, that began at the foot of the Capitol and ran from it down low hills and wide terraces to the Colorado River, three-quarters of a mile away, one would meet most of the men important in Texas politics. Lyndon Johnson, whose Littlefield Building office was at Congress and 6th Street, met them. To some, he could introduce himself because he was Sam Johnson's son. His young assistants were startled, because he spoke so derogatorily of his father, at how many influential men remembered the chief's father, and remembered him in such a way that they were disposed to be friendly to this young man who resembled him so closely that more than one elderly legislator, seeing the long, gaunt frame and the smiling face with the huge ears, white skin, and black hair, coming toward him, thought for a moment that young Sam Johnson was walking Congress Avenue again. He knew others through his work, which gave him entree to the most powerful men in Austin. For despite his youth, he was, after all, a representative, since most federal agencies had established their Texas headquarters in San Antonio or Dallas, practically the only representative, of the central government in this isolated little provincial capital. He was, moreover, a representative of the fabled New Deal, with access to New Deal funds. As much as any man, its representative in the capital of Texas. Influential men with college-age children who needed jobs to help pay their way, or with a child who had recently graduated and could use a job on the NYA staff itself, realized that this young man had such jobs to dispense. Lyndon Johnson had no trouble meeting the most influential men of Texas. Meeting such men, he made friends of them, with the facility and rapidity at winning over older people that had amazed his contemporaries in Johnson City and San Marcos. Nervous about meeting them, worried about the impression he would make, he attempted to disguise the nervousness by appearing totally at ease. Emerging from the Littlefield Building, he would habitually take off his suit jacket and sling it, as if carelessly, over one shoulder. He would turn up the brim of his fedora, turn it up as far as it would go, in fact, so that it touched the crown, in an attempt to add another touch of insouciance. But these attempts at casualness were undermined. Unable to keep from checking his reflection in the windows of the stores he passed, he continually straightened and tightened his necktie. He carried a blue comb clipped to his shirt pocket, and as he walked, he constantly combed his hair, smoothing its waves and pushing higher his pompadour. Even if he was wearing a hat, he would sometimes, staring at his reflection, take the hat off and use the comb, just in case he met someone walking with his wife and had to doff the hat. Despite these preparations, the sight of an influential figure approaching in the distance would precipitate panic. Ducking into the doorway of the nearest store, he would hurriedly tuck in his shirt, recheck his tie, hitch up and carefully adjust his pants and belt, and then pat his pompadour into perfection, after which, looking his absolute best, he would saunter with exaggerated carelessness toward the man for whom these preparations had been made. Witnesses to this Congress Avenue toilette could not keep from laughing. Edward A. Clark, then Texas's Secretary of State, says, "Everyone knew about Lyndon's little blue comb." But the laughter was friendly. Listening at them, sitting at their knees, drinking in their wisdom, following their minds, agreeing with their thoughts before they had uttered them, he made these men like him, and he cemented their affection by hiring their children. Many NYA secretaries were daughters of state influentials. They grew friendly and, increasingly, respectful. When he had been Clayburgh's secretary, Clark says, Everybody in Austin knew Lyndon was a good fellow to see up there if he needed something out of one of the departments. Now, meeting him on Congress Avenue, men who needed something in Washington asked him how to obtain it, and found his advice sound. They told their friends he was a good man to talk to. Good not only on Washington, but on Texas. The state's Byzantine politics seemed to hold no mysteries for him. If politics was the dialect of Austin, this young man, these canny politicians realized, possessed a remarkable fluency. His opinions, cloaked though they were in deference, were worth listening to. Lobbyist Bill Cottrell reminded them that he had told them about Lyndon Johnson years before. This, he said, was the wonder kid he had been talking about. Now, observing Johnson in person, Austin saw that Cottrell's description had been accurate. Of all the men Johnson met in Austin, Ed Clark was the one who would, over the long years to come, acquire and hold the most power. Only 30 years old in 1936, he was already not only Secretary of State, but chief political adviser to Governor James B. Allred, the man you had to see before you could see the governor. Clark, whose folksy, giggling, storytelling manner concealed a hard, shrewd mind, was an astute observer of politicians, and he rationed the time he gave each one according to the assessment he made of his future. He began to make it his business, when Johnson came to call on the governor to solicit his advice on an NYA program, to spend quite a bit of time with Johnson, to be friendly with him, to let Johnson know he could, whenever he might need help, call upon Clark for it. He did so, he recalls, and Ed Clark can always recall exactly why he did things. Because he knew Rayburn, and that meant plenty. Because he was the hardest worker I ever saw, he couldn't relax. Because he had a boundless ability to ingratiate himself with powerful men. Nothing was too much trouble for him to do, for someone who might be able to help him someday. Accompanying Johnson to cocktail parties, Clark saw his nervousness up close. He didn't want to be standing there by himself, Clark would recall. If I started to walk away, he would say, "Stand with me, Ed, stand with me." Insecurity. There was a lot of insecurity in Lyndon. He had some kind of inferiority complex. You could see that right away. But Clark, a great reader of men in his own right, saw beyond the nervousness. I would see him talking to somebody, and I would see what he was doing. He was ingratiating himself. And he could do it so good, I never saw anything like it. He was listening at them. He could start talking to a man at a party, or he could stop a fellow on the street, and in 5 minutes he could get that man to think, "I like you, young fellow, I'll be for you." I considered him a comer. I knew the way he was getting around and meeting the people, getting acquainted. I knew he was figuring on running for office. I didn't know what office he was going to run for, but I knew he was going to run for some office, and I knew he was going to run for a big office, and I was willing to buy a ticket on him. In 1936, legislator Ernest O. Thompson asked Johnson to manage his campaign for the chairmanship of the State Railroad Commission. The commission, unique to Texas, was the body empowered to regulate not only railroads, but the production of oil and natural gas. Its chairman was one of the state's most powerful men, and the popular Thompson, heavily favored to win the post, promised Johnson a commission post with substantial power of his own. Thompson had thought he was doing Johnson a great favor by offering him, at such an early age, statewide power, but Johnson declined the offer. The job was a far more attractive post than the one Lyndon Johnson had asked for not a year before when, still Clayburgh's secretary, he had pleaded with Welly Hopkins for a post on the state attorney general's office. But he was no longer a secretary. Not state, but national power was what he had always wanted. He had known for so long what he wanted to be, what route would take him to his far-off goal. A state job, no matter how good, was not on that road. State politics was, he had said, a dead end. In the frustration, almost desperation, of his last months with Clayburgh, he had almost decided to abandon his chosen road, but with the NYA appointment he was back on it and did not intend to leave it again. The NYA job, attractive as it was not the main chance for which he was looking. but if the main chance came, he would recognize it, and he would grab it. The frenzy on the sixth floor of the Littlefield building bore fruit. Few states met the NYA quotas when schools and colleges reopened in September 1935. NYA Administrator Aubrey Williams was to admit on October 28th that the youth agency had gotten off to a very bad start. But the quota was met in Texas. By September 1936, the Texas NYA program was running with notable efficiency. Returning to campus after the summer vacation, 7,123 students enrolled not only in college, but in the NYA, whose $15 monthly stipend was keeping them in college. At every one of the state's 87 colleges, even the state's four Negro colleges, conspicuously excluded from federal and state aid programs of the past, NYA programs were a smoothly functioning part of campus life. Some 11,061 high school students were receiving smaller but helpful checks. Lyndon Johnson's relationships with Negro colleges and schools during his NYA directorship, significant in light of his later relationship with civil rights legislation, will be explored in depth in Volume 2. The student aid program was, moreover, accomplishing its purpose. In 1935, it had encouraged students to return to school. In 1936, it kept those students in school. The fact that almost 40% of the students receiving NYA help in 1936 had received it in 1935 marked the beginning of a trend that would have pleased Eleanor Roosevelt. With the help of the NYA, a substantial percentage of Texas students who would otherwise, with the Depression still gripping the state, have had to drop out of school, would make it through, year after year, all the way to graduation. By June 1939, the NYA's fourth year, more than 1,000 graduating college seniors had received NYA aid for each of their 4 years. The students the NYA kept in school in Texas were students who deserved to be in school. Of 5,713 NYA-aided college students surveyed during the 1938-39 school year, the grades of 54% were above the school average. 27% had average grades, and only 19% were below average. If the explanation lies partly in the fact that, to some extent, college administrators selected above-average students for NYA help, these students nonetheless kept their marks above average while holding down NYA jobs. The Texas NYA was, in fact, accomplishing purposes only vaguely, if at all, envisioned in Washington, where colleges were often thought of as the ivied, lavish campuses of the Northeast. Many Texas colleges, only a few years old and engaged in a continual struggle just to keep their doors open, had been unable to build needed facilities. For example, 10 years after the founding of Texas Technological College, its campus was still only a treeless, barren tract on the plains just below the Panhandle, with inadequate library and laboratories, and with dormitory space for only 600 of its 3,000 students. Falling enrollment from among the children of the plains, struggling farmers and ranchers, had imperiled its existence. The NYA not only got Texas Tech's students back to school, but put them to work building needed facilities, planting trees and bushes, and sodding the quadrangles. One NYA program, begun in Texas at the suggestion of Lyndon Johnson's old boss, President Cecil Evans of Southwest Texas State Teachers College, was designed to help young people who had never been to college and who, without help, would not be able to go for some time. There were many such youths in Texas who, after graduating from high school, had found that their families, in desperate financial straits, could not spare them from the farm, and who had gone to work, intending to resume their education when the grip of the Depression eased. To educators like Evans, he had watched the enrollment at San Marcos falling steadily since the Depression began. This trend spelled tragedy. In sparsely settled rural areas, higher education was not an accepted part of life. Once youths from these areas dropped off the educational path, they were all too often off it for good, never to return. What was needed, Evans felt, was a way to maintain in such youths, through desperate times, a link with education. to allow them to keep at least a toehold on the path to the better life that they once had sought. To do so, he suggested creation of a freshman college center. At it, students whose families were on relief and who could not be spared from the farm or ranch were offered upon graduation from high school the opportunity to take one or two tuition-free college courses while continuing to live and work at home. A college could not afford to pay the professors for such a center, he said, but the NYA could. And if the teachers hired by the NYA were those who had been laid off by colleges and were now on relief, teachers as well as students would be helped. By March 1936, 20 freshman college centers were operating in Texas. Another NYA program used colleges to help young men and women who didn't want to go to college. Some wanted to stay on the farm. The NYA did not attempt to change their feelings, only to show them how life on the farm could be better than they had known it, while giving them a little cash to ease life there. Rural youths were brought to the campus for a 4-month vocational course in such areas as animal husbandry, dairy manufacturing, farm machinery repair. Experts taught young men how to build sanitary hog wallows and better chicken houses. Young women how to can faster and more efficiently. In return for a monthly NYA wage, boys working under the direction of foremen hired by the NYA built dormitories, and girls sewed sheets and pillowcases to be used in them. Some didn't want to stay on the farm, were in fact desperate to move to a city, even without a college education, but they did not possess the skills that city life required. The farm work they hated was the only work they knew. Often, even the basic skills of plumbing or electricity or mechanical work were mysteries to them, as were the job discipline and the subtleties that children raised in the industrial world learn without thinking about them. Starting work on time, working set hours, taking orders from strangers instead of their father, playing office politics. They lacked, moreover, not only skills, but, because of their isolation, knowledge of the world of which they dreamed. Isolation was all too often unrelieved by reading. Their education in one-room schools had been meager, and, as the Lindleys put it, theirs are not the homes that have books and magazines. And giving them skills and knowledge was, as the Lindleys wrote, a challenge. It is difficult to provide sound work for isolated boys and girls who have no way of getting to or from a construction job, a workshop, or a sewing room in a town 20 miles away from their farms. If the young men and women from the thinly scattered farms of the hill country or the endless barren plains of West Texas, who wanted a different life, were to be given a chance at it, even if the chance was only to become a mechanic, providing the chance would be very difficult. To meet this challenge, resident training centers were established. Texas farm youths were brought together in groups to be taught useful city occupations on 4 college campuses, paying for their instruction by practicing their newly acquired skills on projects the colleges needed. San Marcos, for example, had, years before, purchased 3 white frame houses on College Hill, intending to turn them into laboratories and classrooms. The college had never had enough money to do so, but the college had 50 empty dormitory beds, and 50 youths, paid $21 a month by the NYA, were brought in to work on those houses. Since San Marcos was in the hill country, part of the work had to be done with rock, chipping away at stubborn limestone and digging boulders out of the ground so that pipes could be laid for plumbing, piling the boulders atop one another and cementing them in place as retaining walls. The young men tore out walls, built new ones, installed bathrooms, built stone steps to the front doors, sodded the lawns. This work was done in the mornings. By noon, a solid 6 hours' work had been completed by these farm boys who rose with the sun. In the afternoons, they went to classes. A visitor found that the college's industrial arts building had taken on the appearance of an eastern factory going full blast. At a drafting table in one corner is a lad who has long yearned to know the intricacies of mechanical drawing, poring over his plans and specifications under the eyes of an instructor. Another is at the forge, his eyes glued to the glowing rod he holds in the coals. A group of youths are repairing the engines of college automobiles and maintenance vehicles under the eye of a master mechanic. They learned to read blueprints. NYA instructors insisted that no matter how simple the job, building a chair or a cabinet, for example, the trainee worked from plans, because, as one said, They can't ever expect to earn their livings as carpenters or cabinet makers if they can't read drawings. To make the required mathematical calculations, to learn the properties of materials. The 50 boys went to San Marcos for 4 months. At the end of that time, work on the 3 buildings was half completed. The second group of 50, who arrived the day after the first group left, completed it. And if the college gained 3 dormitories, what the youths acquired, while less tangible, was nonetheless significant to them, whose world had consisted so largely of their families. The very act of getting beyond the boundaries of their own counties was important. A young woman at an NYA resident training center in Arkansas said, "At first I was kind of homesick. You know how it is when you've never been away from home at all, not even farther than 5 miles. Just the feeling of being part not only of a family, but of a group, of living and working with people who were not their relatives, was important. At Johnson's insistence, moreover, resident centers in Texas elected their own self-governing councils, and colleges provided a citizenship course, 28 lectures on subjects ranging from the Constitution to proper table manners. As a college president in Arkansas put it, "The associations these boys get from their new environment would be worth this whole thing even if they didn't get a single other thing." In fact, so poor were some of them that just being fed regularly was important to them. One Texas supervisor says that in their first week or two at an NYA resident center, they might gain 10 to 15 pounds. The program also helped young women, who were brought in from the farms and taught not only the homemaking skills felt appropriate for young women, but secretarial skills, and they too received intangible benefits, as is indicated by one description written by a young woman reporter for the Brenham Banner Press after visiting an NYA resident training center at Washington County Junior College, near Brenham, Texas, at which were studying 28 women, each of whom had been the valedictorian of her high school class, and each of whom had, immediately after graduation, gone back to farm life. "When you were young," the reporter wrote to her audience of farm and small-town readers, "didn't you dream about that grandest of all youthful experiences? The day when you could go to college and live in a dormitory and get an education that would open the portals of the world to you? Certainly we all had that dream, and yet how few of us ever realized it. However, some dreams do come true, and 28 girls are now having their dream of real college life fulfilled." The program of the Texas NYA was hailed throughout the state, declaring that isolated farm families had never before been helped by any government program. The Dallas Journal said, "The lads from the forks of the creeks deserve some chance in life, and the NYA is going to give them that chance." It was hailed beyond the state. Several of its innovations, including the roadside parks, were copied elsewhere. "Similar roadside parks are being built in Oklahoma," the Oklahoma farmer stockman commented, "but Texas seems a little further along with the program." NYA Administrator Williams described Johnson's work as a first-class job. By the end of 1936, more than 20,000 youths were receiving NYA aid, either at school or work, in Texas. And a huge expansion of the state's entire NYA program was planned for the spring of 1937. In 1936, the NYA had built a greenhouse and planted in it more than 6,000 trees and shrubs, which in 1937 were to be transplanted to the scores of new roadside parks scheduled for construction that year. And in 1937, for the first time, the NYA was to begin building not just roadside parks, but bigger parks in towns and cities. Still more substantial projects were to get underway. After 18 months of urging on local officials, a substantial number of proposals for new schools, community centers, and halls to house fire trucks of local fire companies had been received, and the blueprints completed. Materials and equipment had been obtained, and construction was about to start on a dozen of these projects. On February 22, 1937, however, Lyndon Johnson got the chance for which he had been waiting, and without a moment's hesitation, he grabbed it. Chapter 20, The Dam. He got the chance because of a dam, because of what that dam meant to 2 men. The dam was in one of the most deserted regions of the Hill Country. To reach it, you drove northwest out of Austin on a narrow, unpaved, gravel-topped road. About 10 miles deep in the hills, you turned off the road onto an even narrower path that had been hacked through the dense cedar brakes. You bumped along its rough surface for another 8 miles, heading deeper and deeper into the empty hills, passing scarcely a sign of human habitation. Until suddenly the path ended in a void that was a deep, wide canyon. Walking to the edge of the canyon, you looked down, and far below you were a battalion of rumbling bulldozers, scores of trucks, 2,000 scurrying men, and rising out of the bed of the river that had cut the canyon, a broad wall of masonry, 27 stories high and more than a mile long, one of the largest structures built by man. The dam, named Marshall Ford, because it was located at the spot at which cattle from the Marshall Ranch had been driven across the lower Colorado River, before the cedar had covered the hills, gobbled up the last of the grass, and ended grazing in the area, was being built by the United States Bureau of Reclamation to control the floods which periodically roared down the 700-mile-long valley of the lower Colorado, sweeping away the precious fertile soil on its banks. The dam was later renamed Mansfield after the Rivers and Harbors Committee chairman. But to the two men most responsible for its construction, the dam had a more personal significance. To one of them, the significance was simple as the man. His name was Herman Brown, and he wanted to build big things and to make big money building them. He had wanted that for a long time. The son of a Belton, Texas shopkeeper, he went into the construction business in 1909, at the age of 16, earning $2 a day carrying a rod to assist surveyors. Road building, Fresno and mule team road building, was a rough business in Texas then. The weekend sprees of the building crews, tough ex-cowhands and oil field roustabouts, generally landed them in jail, from which the contractor would bail them out on Monday morning, and the crews lived next to the mule corrals in crowded tents. Herman Brown was to live in those tents for almost 10 years. A rather small, slender boy, unexceptional in appearance, he had a way with men. In 1913, when he was 20, he was made a foreman. When, a year later, his boss went broke, he paid off his young foreman's back wages by giving him 4 mules and a Fresno. At the age of 21, Brown was a contractor. Contractors had to know how to handle mules, and they had to know how to handle men. Herman knew how to handle both. With the mules, he was gentle. With the men, he was rough. From his first job, the word about Herman Brown began to get around in the construction industry in Texas. You either do things Herman's way or else. And they had to know how to handle politicians, too, in a state where politics centered on a county courthouse system as corrupt as anything Tammany Hall ever envisioned. Herman had a gift for handling politicians, all the way up the line from the sheriffs who could facilitate the Monday morning bailing out of his crews to the county judges who handed out highway contracts, and an understanding that it was in the pockets of politicians that his slender funds would be most profitably invested. In Texas, political influence was often exerted through lawyers. No matter how tight his finances, and for many years they would be very tight, Herman always found enough for legal fees. Soon he had a road-building contract of his own. Having stretched himself to the limit to finance it, he almost went broke when rains turned the road into a sea of mud and forced him to stop work. At one point, when he could not afford to buy feed for his mules, a local merchant, taking pity on him and the mules, gave him credit. Decades later, Herman learned by chance that the merchant had gone broke in the Depression, and old now was living in poverty on an isolated West Texas ranch. A day or two later, there arrived in the old man's mailbox a check big enough to keep him in comfort for the rest of his life. Soon he had many contracts in counties scattered all across Texas. To oversee these jobs, sometimes hundreds of miles apart, and to bid for new ones in county seats hundreds of miles apart, he spent endless days in a car. For years he would work all day on one job and then sleep in the car while his chauffeur, a very low-paid luxury considering the wage scale for a Negro driver at the time, drove all night to the next job, on which Brown would work all day before getting into the car to sleep while the chauffeur drove all night again to the next job. In a single year, Herman Brown traveled over unpaved, bumpy, rutted roads more than 75,000 miles. That figure was calculated by an aide, not by Herman Brown. He measured not his effort, but the profit it brought. But the profit was, considering the effort, minimal. In so impoverished a state, public works contracts were very small. As late as 1927, the average road construction contract was only $90,000, a sum out of which the contractor had to pay wages for his men and buy feed for his mules, materials and equipment, bonding and insurance. And the profit was often not even in cash. Contractors generally were paid off in paving notes, secured by municipal real estate, and due to mature in 5 or 10 years, by which time various tiny Texas towns and sparsely inhabited counties hoped to have sufficient cash to redeem them. Herman Brown had been living in a tent on the job in 1909. He was still living in a tent when he wasn't living in that car in 1917 when he married a pert young college graduate, Margaret Root. It was to a tent that he brought his bride for their wedding night, and the tent was their first home. As important to him as profit was the scale of the work he was doing. With the vision of the great builder, he thought in terms of projects that would leave his mark on the face of the earth, for centuries. On his first visit to Rome, he headed straight for the Colosseum and, with a penknife, chipped away at its stone to collect samples, which he would take back to Texas for an analysis of its composition. At last he would know, he said, what the Romans had put into it to make the Colosseum stand for 2,000 years. In Texas, however, the scale was as unsatisfactory as the money. The state could not afford public works of the size of which Herman Brown dreamed. Herman Brown had two partners. He acquired the first because he loved his wife. At her request, he took her brother, Dan, the Root of Brown and Root, into the business. He acquired the second after Dan had died. The name of the firm was left unchanged out of Herman's deference to his wife's feelings, because he loved his younger brother, George. Having quit college, George was working for Anaconda Copper in its great mines near Butte, Montana, attempting to break into the engineering end of the company. He had advised his superiors where to drill to hit a new copper vein, and although his shift ended at 3 a.m., he had risen at 6 and had gone along into the deserted mine to see if they had hit. He saw, as he was careful to emphasize 50 years later, that they had hit, but in his moment of jubilation, the mine caved in. Falling rock fractured his skull and cut open a vein. I could see the blood spurting out of my head. The floor started to collapse beneath him, leaving a seemingly bottomless pit below, but there was a beam there, 12 inches wide, and I got to it as the shaft caved in. Lying down on that 12 inches of steel over the chasm, I pressed the vein in my head against a rock with that side of my head down, and when I became unconscious, that shut off the bleeding. 8 hours later, George Brown was brought out of the mine with fractures not only of his skull but of bones throughout his body. He was sent home to Belton, and when Herman heard how close George had come to death, he let his penniless brother have half of the business he had spent 10 years building up at terms he could afford. Herman was still the absolute boss of Brown and Root, and always would be, a situation with which George was perfectly content. Asked what he did in the business, George would reply, "What Herman doesn't do." But Herman wasn't the only one of the brothers with soaring ambitions, and with a willingness to work as hard as was necessary to achieve them. A third brother was not willing. After a month in the business, he left, telling Herman, "I don't want to work these 18-hour days. You'll kill yourself." He returned to his job as a streetcar conductor. George was sent to supervise the building of a small bridge over the San Gabriel River. He had never built a bridge, had never built anything, but he built that bridge and made a profit on it. Gradually, the desperate days faded away. It was no longer necessary for Herman Brown to live in a tent. He still spent many nights driving back and forth across Texas, but when he got home, it was to a handsome, white-pillared house at 4 Niles Road, in the fashionable Enfield Road section of Austin. Though he was comfortable, however, Herman Brown was not wealthy, or even particularly well off. Texas jobs were still small jobs. The pay for them was still often in paving notes. He was always short of cash. After 20 years of terrible effort, the man who had wanted to build big things had still never built anything big. In 1927 and 1928, moreover, the Brown brothers began to realize that the paving notes which represented most of their resources, might never be paid. The Depression had already begun in Texas. Municipalities couldn't pay their debts. New construction jobs were scarce. Brown & Root's cash shortage became serious. The firm's banker advised Herman to sell the notes at a discount to get whatever he could for them. George remembers, "Our banker in Houston, in 1927 and 28 and 29, he kept telling us, 'You're going to have to sell that paper.'" Herman wouldn't do it. Those notes represented years of effort. He could not bear the thought of selling them for a fraction of their face value, for a fraction of what he had earned. But finally, in 1929, we had to sell it. I went to Chicago and sold it just before the Depression. We had to discount it, but it was a good thing we sold it. Another month or two, and we wouldn't have been able to. And if they hadn't had the money realized from its sale, Brown & Root would have been out of business. By 1930, George Brown says, "Everything was broke down here in this part of the world. It was a good thing we sold it. Because we did, we were the only contractors in Texas who could keep men on the payroll." Herman Brown managed to preserve the organization it had taken him so many years to create, although there was little work for it. We lived off that paper in 1930 and 1931 and 1932, for years, really, during the Depression. And by 1936, the paper, to be precise, the proceeds Brown and Root had obtained from selling it, was running out. After 20 years as a contractor, Herman Brown was almost broke. And then in 1936, the Bureau of Reclamation announced that it was taking bids for a $10 million dam at the Marshall Ford. It was the job, the big job, for which Herman had been waiting all his life. To the other man, the significance of the dam was subtle as the man. He was Alvin J. Wirtz, the former state senator who had come to Washington in 1935 and been helped in his efforts to obtain federal funding for the newly formed Lower Colorado River Authority by Richard Clayburgh's young secretary. Because of the thoroughness with which the life of Franklin Roosevelt has been chronicled, the men who helped him to power, burly, bald, gregarious Jim Farley, for example, wizened, wheezing Louis Howe, have themselves become minor but vivid historical figures, our century's Northumberlands and Worcesters. Because the life of Lyndon Johnson, particularly the early decades of his life, the rise to power, has never been chronicled with either depth or accuracy, the figure of Alvin Wirtz has never emerged from the shadows. Johnson said of him, "Alvin Wirtz was my dearest friend, my most trusted counselor. From him, I gained a glimpse of what greatness there is in the human race." Lady Bird called him the lodestar of our lives. And in the long picture gallery at the Johnson Ranch, his picture hangs prominently and bears the identification written by Mrs. Johnson. "Senator A.J. Wirtz, the captain of my ship any day." There is, however, some aptness in the fact that shadows surround the figure of Alvin Wirtz, for it was in the shadows that he worked. One would not think it to meet him on Congress Avenue, a big, burly man with a broad, ever-present smile, and be favored with his open, friendly greeting, or to sit across from him in his unpretentious law office in the Littlefield building as he chatted amiably, tilted comfortably back in his low swivel chair, smoking a big black cigar. This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.